Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Family Secrets, The Case That Crippled the Chicago Mob, by Jeff Cohen. Narrated by Matthew Boston. This only have I found. God made mankind upright, but men have gone in search of many schemes. Ecclesiastes. Author's Note. Source material for this book consists primarily of court transcripts, interviews with central players in the case, trial exhibits, and notes taken while I covered the Family Secrets trial for the Chicago Tribune during the summer of 2007. Many of the quotations in the book were taken from transcripts, most notably in chapters that cover the trial testimony of Nick Calabrese and Joey the Clown Lombardo. Accounts of conversations recorded at the federal prison in Milan, Michigan, also were taken from transcripts of the actual discussions. The government prepared printed versions of the Milan conversations, which became trial exhibits. Other reference material included stories from the archives of the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. Prior to the time I covered the case for the Tribune, many detailed stories on family secrets were produced by Tribune reporters Matt O'Connor and Todd Lighty, former Tribune reporter Rudolph Bush, and Tribune columnist John Cass. Reporter Steve Warmber covered the case and the trial for the Sun-Times, and his work is widely respected as well. Reuters' coverage of the Las Vegas case involving the Spilatros and the Hole-in-the-Wall gang was reviewed, as were stories by the late John O'Brien, a legendary Tribune scribe whose colorful stories are still remembered at the Tribune Tower and the Dirksen U.S. Courthouse in Chicago. One final important note. The narrative accounts of murders included in the book were taken from the testimony of trial witnesses and case documents. Most of the descriptions of homicides included in the case and repeated here were provided to the government during debriefings of Nick Calabrese and later by Nick himself to the Family Secrets jury, which was not able to unanimously assign blame for all of the killings. 1. A Killing Between Friends. Taking a life was like a riddle to be solved or a puzzle to be slowly pieced together, and by 1986, Nick Calabrese was a pretty patient guy. He was hardly the bruising movie version of the mob hitman, some beefcake with a machine gun and a chiseled jaw who bursts into a restaurant in a pinstripe suit to flatten someone, sending plates of ravioli and a checkered tablecloth flying. There was no swagger or bravado about him. You could walk toward him on the street and pass by without a second thought or glance. He had an everyman appearance, to be sure, but many would have been wiser not to be fooled. Nick was a deadly and cool technician. He would stalk his victims, trailing them and learning as he watched them move. Sometimes his hit squads would lurk for weeks, looking for the best way to strike and then escape detection. Follow the target long enough, and a pattern would emerge. Eventually, a weak spot in his daily routine could be recognized and then efficiently exploited. There was almost always a time when the victim's guard would be down or he could be found in an opportune spot. Trickery and deceit were preferred to the daylight ambush. Making a good kill was about guile and cunning and surprise, and not always blasting in and then out if need be. Finding the right angle or lure usually made all of that unnecessary. The idea, of course, was not to get caught. So the Chicago outfit liked to take its victims to secret places such as garages or basements, closed businesses or empty buildings. Its killers appeared like phantoms and vanished quickly. For the least accessible victims, maybe a bomb was the answer, as the outfit took every step to try to keep the advantage. Men like Nick were responsible for figuring out how the killing should be accomplished, and then doing what had to be done and disappearing, though sometimes they would stop for coffee when they were through. There was no bragging and no returning to the scene of the crime to take it in. Most of the time, it was only later that the sinister handiwork would turn up, a body in a gully or stuff mostly naked in a trunk, tied up and contorted with a gaping wound to the neck. In many ways, that layer of mystery was better when the goal was keeping Chicago's criminal underworld in line, sending a constant, threatening chill over the streets. For some, the threat of being killed was always there, and felt as if it could come from any direction. That was good business for the mob, keeping outfit associates and customers alike looking over their shoulder. Break the outfit's rules or don't pay when you're supposed to pay, and that could be it. The next time anyone sees you, there's a group of cops standing over your corpse, with flashes going off while your picture is taken for the file. Bosses in the Chicago outfit marked many for death to protect the organization, sometimes from a witness who might talk to the feds, and sometimes to punish a member who stepped out of line or brought too much heat. Sometimes it was just to make a bloody example out of an enemy, and Nick was among the trusted few called upon to do the ugliest of jobs. Nick was a weapon, although a mostly reluctant one. He allowed himself to begin down the dark path, never having the courage to make it all stop. He had been in the Navy and had held real jobs. He'd been a union iron worker and had a family. None of that had involved digging holes or lying in wait for the unwary with a rope or a gun. Maybe he could have found the courage to tell them he was through. But once in the outfit, there was no deciding to quit, no retirement parties, no turning away and deciding you'd had enough. He wanted to run, but where was he supposed to go? There was really only one way out, death, and Nick was afraid of that consequence. It was an oppressive fear, a fear that had a name and a face that stayed with him, as close as a brother. It was Frank Calabrese Sr., a successful outfit loan shark who had started Nick's slow sink into the Chicago syndicate. It had been almost harmless at first, after all. Nick would help Frank Sr., a member of the mob's Chinatown street crew, make sense of scrawled loan notes and betting slips. He would collect envelopes and track what debtors owed, parking out of sight and walking to meet them where he could take their tribute. He would help run sports bookmaking and hold his brother's many agents accountable. It was a way for Nick to make a little extra cash, above and beyond what he could make doing his legitimate work. The quiet Nick was a paper-and-numbers guy, at least at the beginning, not a vicious killer. In 1970, the first time he watched his brother plunge a knife into someone's throat, he wet himself, he was so scared. It was dark and his pants were grimy with the dirt of the South Side construction site where they would hide the body in a small pit, so neither his brother nor his brother's henchmen had noticed. He had started as the ride-along, the spare hand, but some 16 years later, he was the kind of soldier those in command of the outfit valued, no matter his reasons for being a part of it. He asked no questions and caused no trouble, a trait appreciated by the harsh men in charge. They needed to give an order and have it carried out with merciless determination. Nick was given a job, and in a Chicago lunch bucket kind of way, it got done. He would return with a quick word or make a coded phone call where he talked about having soup or something, and the mob's business could go on. His brother passed an order from the bosses, and Nick was in, fearing what might lie in store for him if he said no. There were mobsters with more bluster, intense men who would yell and threaten and instill fear, but it's the quiet ones you never see coming. That's not to say that some things always went perfectly when Nick was told to take a life. Sometimes the adrenaline would kick in too strong and force mistakes. When the heart raced too fast, it could be hard to stay focused. In the dark, with a begging, struggling victim, things could get confusing quickly. There was the time Nick helped kill another mobster lured from a neighborhood club, placing the beaten, strangled, and stabbed man in his car and leaving it parked on a residential street. When it was over, his street crew's capo, or captain, had demanded that the body and the car be burned. So Nick went back and doused the man's corpse in Zippo lighter fluid in the back seat and lit it. But in his haste, he left all the windows rolled up and snuffed out the flames when he shut the car door. Only a fresh snow covered that error, at least for a few weeks. And there was the time in Phoenix Nick had pulled a grand jury witness into a van and shot him in the head. It had taken
Sample complete. Ready to continue?